talk about something before the lawyers join us? So I want everybody to be unmuted.
Okay.
Is everyone sitting on this case? The only one I had a non-participation on was on Thursday's argument, the second case. Brian's not on.
As far as I know, everyone's on this.
Everybody's on? Okay, because I didn't have a note on it that it wasn't.
For our, we may want to discuss this later, Pat, but since the attorneys aren't here now, for our conference post-argument, do you know what link we're supposed to be using?
I do, and that's what I was going to bring up when everyone was here. You go back to the original Zoom that we used for our closed conferences. Mm-hmm. So the one that you started with is the one that we used, not the Tammy Johnson one.
It is the March 25th one.
Yep.
I always have to go and find it, aren't I?
Yeah. Justice Kelly, we're still looking for Justice Ballot and Justice Hagedorn, and Julie Rich. So. Okay, so all the justices are here. When we have our conference, when this is over, you go back to the original Zoom meeting, which Ann says it's on March 25th. And maybe every day before oral argument, we should resend that as the conference agenda date. But we still don't have Julie Rich. And I just texted her, and she said she's... Julie Rich is our court commissioner, and this is an OLR matter, and she is the court commissioner in charge of it. Generally, she participates in oral argument.
Actually, a BBE.
Yeah, but, okay, that's right, it is BBE. But she's still our court commissioner that's responsible, so... You find her? Okay, good, because she's been waiting. I texted her a little bit ago. When we get done with this argument on Hammer, we'll do a break, and then we'll do the OLR, not OLR, BBE one first, so that we can spend more time on the other two, which I think are more complicated cases.
Sounds good. You said the meeting invite is from March 25th?
Yeah, it's from March 25th.
Yeah, that'd be great if we could send that out. I feel like I'm overloaded with Zoom invitations.
That's right, I know.
Isn't that the original one, Pat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
612-905-549, and then the password is 686-590.
Okay, thank you, Annette.
Does that help?
Yeah, you can put her in right now.
612-905-549. And then the password is 686-590. Now I'll put it back in the vault.
Okay. It looks like something's going to pop up, but I haven't seen her yet.
Connecting to audio.
be watching it, which she can do just as well, too.
Yeah, that's true, too.
But at the bottom, it says Supreme Court Commissioner connecting to audio like it's working, right?
That's what I see, too.
It doesn't seem to be working very well, however.
Okay, all right, just a sec.
I was thinking it's probably a good thing there aren't a lot of people in the courtroom with all the echoing and whatnot.
She said she's on hold by the meeting host.
There she is.
Oh, we see her now. Okay, good. And she's out in the farm fields. I see that. Okay. Well, she can stay muted because she just listens. You can bring the lawyers in now and we can go forward. We should all mute ourselves, too, if we're not speaking. It cuts down on the echo. Attorney Hammer, Attorney Rothstein, all of the justices are assembled. Our court commissioner, Julie Rich, is also watching. And so we are about to commence this argument. You will note there is a space that says Tammy Johnson that has a picture of a mural from the Supreme Court. In that space, you will see a notice to start. Then you'll have a red card that gives you 5 minutes. We are about to commence this argument. A green card for a 5-minute warning and a red card that says stop on it. So if you're colorblind, the red and the green won't help you much, but the words will help a whole bunch. So we are now going to call the next case, Hammer versus Board of Bar Examiners. Attorney Hammer, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is David Hammer, and I am the pro se petitioner in this petition for review of the decision of the Board of Bar Examiners. Thank you for granting my petition for oral argument and for giving me an opportunity to appear before you. I especially appreciate the court's efforts today to hear my argument in light of these difficult times. Given my technology background, I appreciate some of the unique challenges and solutions that have been implemented. I decided to appear today pro se because this is one of the 5 most important moments in my life, and I wanted the opportunity to answer Your Honor's questions directly. While it is both my first and last time appearing before you as a party, I hope to appear before you again in the future as a member of the State Bar of this county. I recognize that the record before this court is extensive, so let us narrow the scope of the issues we have to discuss today. First, the parties agree on the proper standard of review. Factual findings in the BBE proceeding are reviewed for clear error. Legal conclusions are reviewed de novo. The board did make some factual findings, which I've argued in my brief are clearly erroneous. However, I concede that, all in all, the board's factual findings were quite thorough. The small percentage of them, which are erroneous, constitute harmless error. Of course, if this court has any questions about any specific factual findings, I'll be happy to answer them. But otherwise, for the purpose of this presentation, let us assume that the facts are all agreed, and that we're engaging in a de novo review of the board's legal conclusions as applied to the agreed set of facts. Second, within this court's de novo review, we must identify the principles of law for this court to apply. This court has adopted Administrative Rule DA 6.02 and DA 6.03 in furtherance of SDR 40.46 as a basic framework to analyze my past conduct in determining whether I have sufficient character and fitness to practice law in the state of Wisconsin. In addition, this court has provided us with about 20 decisions in the past 25 years. In those decisions, this court analyzed the factors in DA 6.02 and and BA 6.03, as applied to fact patterns presented by various applicants. I respectfully suggest that those factors applied to my case should result in the conclusion that I be admitted to the State Bar of Wisconsin. In addition to those factors, the board raised another issue which I feel we must address. At the hearing, the board inquired at great length, including inquiring of my witnesses, into my relationship with the state of Wisconsin, my connections to the state of Wisconsin, and my motivation in coming to Wisconsin. I answered the board's questions truthfully and completely. However, under the United States Supreme Court ruling in Supreme Court of New Hampshire v. Piper, it is clear that this line of inquiry violates the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the United States Constitution. Under Piper, this court is required to consider me a Florida resident exactly the same as if I were born in Milwaukee, attended Marquette University Law School, and never left the state. In determining the character and fitness of an applicant to practice law, there is no factor to intend to live in Wisconsin, to intend to practice law.
Counsel, in what particular way do you believe you've been treated differently because you are a resident of the state of Florida?
Thank you, Justice Kelly. In the board's order and decision, in multiple instances, it said that it failed to believe my testimony. It did not, it found my testimony not credible. Well, when it said it found my testimony not credible, it didn't explain the alternative scenario that it believed to be true. It said that it believed I was lying in some way. I assure this court I wasn't.
Sure, but that doesn't have anything to do with you being a Florida resident, does it?
Well, I think it might, Your Honor, and the reason I think it might is because I believe that those conclusions are a pretext for discrimination against me as a Florida resident. In fact, even in this court synopsis, it pointed out the board's comment that it was perplexed by my decision to apply to practice law in the state of Wisconsin. Well, there is no factor to intend to live in Wisconsin or practice law in Wisconsin. If I were a Wisconsin resident, that comment wouldn't have been there. I would be treated just like everyone else, but
well,
I haven't.
I think perhaps the inquiry there related more to a query about why you did not seek reinstatement in the state of Florida, where you are a resident, and why you chose to apply for admission here. I don't think that indicates any disapprobation of your residency status as a Florida resident. I think it's a fairly natural question. Why didn't you seek reinstatement in the state of Florida?
Thank you, Justice Kelly. I didn't seek reinstatement in the state of Florida because reinstatement is not a possible remedy in the state of Florida. The Florida rules and laws are a little different from Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, disbarment is not a remedy that is applied to Wisconsin lawyers. There is suspension and there is revocation. In Florida, I was disbarred, which means I am no longer a member of the Florida Bar. So reinstatement is not an option for me.
Sure. So the process you would have to go through to become an active attorney in the state of Florida is actually very similar to what you would need here in Wisconsin, correct? You'd have to pass the bar and then pass the character and fitness requirements and then be admitted by the Supreme Court of either Florida or Wisconsin. That seems to be pretty similar, correct?
Precisely, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. So then why did you opt to come to Wisconsin to do that rather than doing that in court?
Because when I decided to rejoin the practice of law after 8 years since my disbarment, I was eligible to apply in Florida, as Your Honor just suggested. However, I considered, after great introspection and consultation with counsel, whether when I sought to resume the practice, if I should do so in the jurisdiction that I practiced previously or a different jurisdiction. And the answer was clear that I should resume my practice in a different jurisdiction. I made a whole lot of very, very bad during my classes, and I thought that the most likely path to a successful practice in the future would be in a different jurisdiction.
And that's a fair question to ask, isn't it? And that seems like a fair answer. I just want to make sure I understand why you believe that asking that kind of question would be violative of the privileges and immunities clause.
Well, you know, the question that Your Honor asked was not the only one that the board asked at the August 2nd, 2019 hearing. There were extensive questions about why Wisconsin, what is my connection to Wisconsin? And, I mean, the question Your Honor asked, I think, is a fair one. But the amount, the length and the breadth of the questions that were asked and the focus that was put on a necessity for me to have some connection to the state of Wisconsin as a potential factor in evaluating my character and fitness seems to be violative. This court issued a decision in a case called Crow back in 1987. And in Crow, it was evaluating a petitioner's claim that his experience in as corporate counsel for a company outside of Wisconsin did not satisfy the legal experience rule, and he had to take a bar exam. And this court explained that Piper didn't apply there because Crow would have had the opportunity to apply that legal experience requirement if he had been licensed in the same jurisdiction that he had his experience as corporate counsel, whatever jurisdiction that might be.
Okay.
And therefore, Piper didn't apply.
Yeah, counsel, and thank you for that. I don't want to get you sidetracked from making your case that you satisfy the character and fitness requirement. So if I could direct your attention back to that, and perhaps you could just give us the best evidence you have that you do, in fact, satisfy the character and fitness requirements for admission.
Certainly. So this court is aware of the fact that the board presented under BA 6.02, and in response to Your Honor's question, I won't review those at the time unless you'd like me to. So I'm going to jump right into BA 6.03. And in a case called Sagansky, this court found that the board is required to consider all of the applicable factors in BA 6.03. The first one is age. My four-year law practice occurred from ages 24 till 28, and the issues that the board took primarily occurred during, pursuant to, and in connection with my four-year law practice in the state of Florida. As Justice Ann Walsh Bradley observed during the Hauserman oral argument, the male brain does not finish fully developing until age 28 or 29. And while I make no attempt to excuse my conduct, I suggest that my age at the time of my conduct lessens its significance in determining my character and fitness today. The second BA 6.03 factor is recency. My troubling conduct was over 10 years ago. I've had one traffic citation in the past 7 years and have not had any other issues. Virtually all of the applicants who this court determined had sufficient time elapsed since their troubling conduct had less time than I have had. Jarrett had less than 4 years. Anderson had less than 5 years. Vander Perrin had 6 years. Ripple had 4 years. In Hauserman, this court's most recent bar admission decision, during oral arguments, there was extensive discussion of how long before Mr. Hauserman should reapply, as his criminal conduct had occurred only 3 years earlier. Sagansky, Craig, Gaylord, Radke, and Heckman each required only 1 or 2 years before reapplying. Only Leroy Martin, who actually applied to law school from prison and did not disclose it, was not invited to reapply. Given my age at the time of my conduct and the time that has lapsed since my conduct, under the law of this court, if this court determines that I lack sufficient character and fitness to practice law today and denies my application, it will effectively pronounce me forever banned from the practice of law, because no further amount of time will change anything.
Counselor,
in its order and decision,
could you point us to, between the time of your disbarment and today, Could you point us to any positions or activities in which you've been engaged that require trust? And just that perhaps as a way for us to get a sense of your character and fitness in those circumstances.
Sure. So first, you know, since my disbarment, I had a tremendous amount to overcome that a bunch of issues that I created during my law practice that I successfully resolved. I resolved my debt and my financial issues. I pay my debt as they come due. I purchased a home for my family 3 years ago. In terms of requiring trust, I co-founded a business using my technology skills. I care for my family. My wife is 15 years, our two children, and our extended family, including her 85-year-old grandma. So in terms of positions that require trust, I don't know that I've taken on any such positions in the past 10 years, but I've tried to do the right thing in my life and manage my affairs, my finances appropriately, and take care of my family, and just do the right thing and make the world a better place every day. I hope for this an opportunity from this court to do that within the practice of law and to apply all that I've learned in this very difficult period in my life. I've learned a lot. I've learned very difficult lessons. I've accepted those lessons, and I am now fully ready to apply what I've learned if this court's willing to give me a chance.
Counsel, other than you telling us all those things, is there any other points that we can look at for proof, such as, evidence of rehabilitation is one of the factors, and I don't know if you've gone through any kind of treatment or if there's other things you've been involved in besides just taking care of your family. I mean, is there something else besides kind of the basics that we would look to show that something's changed for you?
Yes, Your Honor. And you can actually look to the record in this case. The record includes page 991 of the record, a syllabus for an individualized training program in legal ethics that I underwent with attorney Dean Dietrich, who I retained as an ethics expert to help prepare me to practice law in the state of Wisconsin. I underwent that very seriously. If there are some other things that this court would like me to do, I offer to this court, number one, I'll accept any conditions this court wishes to impose upon me. So if there's some sort of evaluation, treatment, anything else that this court feels would be appropriate or even useful, I'd urge it to err on the side of caution and to impose such a condition. And of course, at my expense, I will gladly undergo whatever it is this court wishes for me to undergo and to report as frequently and as comprehensively as this court would like. I just want a chance to practice law. It's been a very long time. My conduct was quite serious. I make no attempt to minimize it. But I don't think that it was so serious under the law of this court, considering some of the other applicants and cases that this court has considered, that I should be banned from the practice of law forever. I call to the court's attention the case in the matter of the bar admission of Ripple. And the court said, ultimately, we are of the opinion that the incidents from Ms. Ripple's past, while certainly troubling, are not of sufficient gravity for us to conclude that Ms. Ripple should be forever barred from admission to the practice of law in this state. So I would suggest, Your Honor, that yes, my conduct was quite troubling and quite serious and quite egregious. It also occurred over 10 years ago when I was less than 28 years old. And there have not been any troubling issues for the past 10 years. So I would suggest that in this kind of circumstance, the appropriate result would be my admission to the practice of law, and I would suggest that this court impose whatever conditions it wishes to ensure that I keep my promise to this court and to the profession, that I will practice law in an ethical and compliant manner and apply everything that I've learned to help others if this court's willing to give me that chance. I'd like to raise just a couple other points. I'd like to raise 6.03G. I think it's particularly given the length and extent of the record in this case, the court should consider that my application was perfectly candid. The board did not identify a single instance of any item I failed to disclose fully and accurately. And in many of the decisions from this court in the past 25 years, where the court ultimately reversed the BBE decision and admitted the applicant on kind of conditions, many of them even failed to disclose their issues properly and accurately. I mean, even as recently as Jarrett, he failed to report three of his speeding tickets in Nichols, which the court reversed. He didn't report an eviction case against him, a restraining order, a sobriety violation. The record that I developed during my very poor decisions, during my very brief practice of law in my mid-20s, I went to great lengths to disclose every word, every piece, and give the board and the court all the information in the best way I knew how. And my conduct was quite serious. I make no attempt to diminish that. But I suggest that in light of some of the other cases that this court has issued and some of the applicants who have been before this court, that my conduct wasn't so serious that I should be banned from the practice of law forever. So I would only ask that this court give me another chance to practice.
Counsel, I don't know if you're sufficiently familiar with our cases on this, but if you had been a member of the Wisconsin State Bar when this conduct occurred in your 20s, what do you believe the discipline would have likely been from this court?
Thank you, Your Honor. If I had been a member of the Wisconsin State Bar and had committed the same misdeeds in Wisconsin, I believe that my discipline would have been anywhere from a 6 to 18 month suspension. That is supported both by Dean Dietrich's expert testimony, which was rendered at the BBE hearing on August 2, 2019, and I can cite a few cases if this court would like. I would cite the OLR v. Terry Thompson, OLR v. Thad Jelinski, and OLR v. Ross. All three of them involve trust account violations. Some involve violations where money was just outright stolen, which I submit that in my case it was not, though it was taken without authorization, which is not okay and not excusable and not forgivable. It also could have been a lot worse. And in each of those cases, suspensions were issued in between 6 and 18 months, after which I would have had the opportunity to have my license, to apply to have my license reinstated, as Your Honor previously suggested. If the court doesn't have any questions, I'll conclude at this point and thank you again for the opportunity.
Very good. Attorney Rothstein, are you ready to begin? You're still muted. Can you unmute her? Tough to do an oral argument when you can't talk, right? I think from my screen it looks like you're okay to go. Okay, so you may begin, please.
And may it please the court. The central issue in today's matter is whether David Hammer has, in fact, established establish the requisite character and fitness to practice law in Wisconsin. When determining... Are you able to hear me?
I'm able to hear you just fine. Yeah. And I can't speak for Attorney Hammer, but I assume he can also.
Okay, very
yes,
good.
Yes, he can hear you too. Okay.
All right. The central issue in today's matter is whether David Hammer has, in fact, established the requisite character and fitness to practice law in Wisconsin. When determining whether an applicant is eligible for admission to the Wisconsin Bar, the Board of Bar Examiners is required to consider each individual's character and fitness. Applicants for bar admission must establish good moral character and fitness to practice law before being admitted in this state. The Board of Bar Examiners maintains that Mr. Hammer has not met that threshold requirement because he has failed to a reasonable degree of certainty to establish that he has the necessary integrity essential for the practice of law. Indeed, Mr. Hammer has manifested a notable deficiency with regard to his honesty, diligence, and reliability, and as such, the board's decision to deny his certification for admission should be upheld. To better understand how the Board of Bar Examiners reached its determination, a review of the facts in the applicant's case may be helpful. Mr. Hammer became licensed
Before you do that,
yes.
I just want to make sure, is our standard for character and fitness for admission the same as for reinstatement?
Well, I don't, obviously I'm not engaged in reinstatements after there's been a disciplinary matter. We only handle reinstatements in the Board of Bar Examiners after somebody's failed to maintain their CLE over a period of time. So the standards certainly, I think, are different depending on what the circumstances are.
Please proceed.
Again, I think it would be helpful at this point to review the facts in this particular applicant's history.
Before you get to that, I want to follow up Justice Kelly's question. At the hearing, cases were presented that indicated a 6 to 18 month suspension for this type of conduct. Do you have any reason to quarrel with that assessment?
In other words, are you saying that, pardon me, 1 minute. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, just making sure that the computer was plugged in, my apologies. I do not necessarily dispute how this matter might have been perceived by the Office of Lawyer Regulation. But I think it's important to note that we did not handle this from that perspective. We handle this from an initial perspective, looking at it as an applicant from the very beginning.
Yes, I understand that. And I think there has been a different standard applied, and I just wondered if, since the cases were cited back in the autumn when the hearing occurred, if you in any way disputed the accuracy of the assessment that's advanced by the expert witness.
The expert witness being Attorney Dietrich?
Mm-hmm.
Well, while I may not take exception to the cases he cites, we do take exception to his ultimate decision or determination about Mr. Hammer.
Okay, thank you.
If I could just follow up on that.
People are trying to get to a little bit here is, do we really parallel the amount of time someone should be suspended for with an initial determination of that same person in regard to character and fitness to be admitted for the first time. And I think the parallel that apparently Attorney Dietrich tried to draw was that this kind of conduct wouldn't preclude readmission at any particular point in time, but that what you're telling us is you're starting from the beginning, looking at someone as to whether this someone has the character and fitness to practice, yet what you are using as part of that determination, and when I say you, I mean BBE, is his past practices before the Florida bar, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So I think that's where there's a little bit of a disconnect for me, but I think that's where the questions are going from Justice Kelly and Justice Ann Walsh.
Understood, and I do think that there is a distinction in that this is not a readmission, this is an initial admission, and this particular applicant brings quite a bit of history to the table, and the board considered that as part of its review.
Director Osteen, is there a reason that we should look at this differently, given that it's an admission as opposed to a reinstatement? That is to say, is the discipline-worthy conduct more troubling as an initial matter as opposed to a matter of reinstatement? And if so, why?
Well, I do think that it should be considered as an admissions matter, not as a readmission. He's never been admitted in this jurisdiction in the first instance, and I think he brings an awful lot of concern with that, and I do think that if the applicant would demonstrate a sufficient amount of rehabilitation,
that sounds an awful lot like what we inquire into when we're dealing with reinstatements, right? So what I'm trying to figure out, because I want to know if we can look to our reinstatement cases for guidance in how we handle this situation. So what I'm trying to get at is there a principled difference in the way we should be looking at the past misconduct when we're looking at this as a matter of admission as opposed to a matter of reinstatement? Is there a principled distinction between the two?
Well, the Supreme Court rules allow the board to consider discipline in another jurisdiction as a basis for denial. So yes, I do think that there is an important distinction to be made and one that should be considered here.
So if the misconduct occurs in another state, that could be sufficient to forever bar entry to admission here, although if he had been admitted here when he committed the misconduct, he would be able to seek reinstatement after a certain period of time.
Well, certainly that would be up to the court to make that determination, correct?
That anybody who seeks readmission has already at one point in time proved they do have the character and fitness to practice law. So they have that foundation that they drifted away from, and that was the reason for suspension or perhaps revocation. Does that matter in the board's determination where with Attorney Hammer, there is no foundation that at one point in time he was found by BBE to have character and fitness to practice in Wisconsin.
Well, that's true because his initial admission was not in this state. It was in Florida. So we're looking at him as a brand new applicant who, to the board's way of reviewing him, didn't meet the essential criteria for admission. He did not demonstrate satisfactorily that he has the character and fitness necessary for admission in this jurisdiction, even if arguably he had it at one point in Florida.
Is there anything that he could do to establish sufficient character and fitness in Wisconsin to justify admission, or is his prior misconduct in Florida a permanent bar?
Well, I think, know, the questions that both you and Justice Dallet asked get in part to that, which is to say, has he, for example, engaged in any significant positions of trust since his disbarment? And based on Mr. Hammer's response, you heard that he's done what many of us do. You know, he's maintained the family, he's purchased a home, he's engaged in a business, all of which is laudable and legitimate, but it doesn't really go to your question, which is, what has he done to earn the trust of others, other than his immediate family members? And I don't believe, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, I don't believe that the ethics course that he engaged in is sufficient to meet that threshold either. Again, with regard to the facts in this case, Mr. Hammer was licensed as an attorney in Florida in 2006, and roughly 4 years later, in September of 2010, the Supreme Court of Florida disbarred him from the practice of law. He was alleged to have misappropriated client funds for his own personal use, and those misappropriation of funds began in January of 2010, when he began taking money from trust funds that belonged to a variety of entities controlled by a man named Paul Bilzerian. A couple of months prior to that time, in November of 2009, Mr. Bilzerian had directed that outstanding invoices and cost reimbursements not be paid to Mr. Hammer, although Mr. Hammer thought they were owed to him. During that same time frame, Mr. Hammer was holding trust funds belonging to another one of the Bilzerian entities. Beginning in January of 2010, Mr. Hammer began taking money from the trust account for his own personal use. And in May of that same year, his client demanded the money that was being held in trust. When that demand was made, the trust fund was approximately $27,000 short of funds. Meanwhile, as that was transpiring, Mr. Hammer was also a signatory on another account, and in order to reimburse the missing funds from the trust account, he paid himself director fees and additional amounts from that other account that he claimed that were owed to him without first obtaining prior authority to do so. As a result of that conversion, the Florida Supreme Court disbarred him. Mr. Hammer has argued that he did not convert client funds. The Board of Bar Examiners disagrees and maintains that whether or not he ultimately reimbursed the account, he took the funds for his own use, thereby converting them. His repayment in no way acts to absolve him of his underlying wrongdoing. Mr. Hammer's conduct speaks for itself. He took funds that were not his to take and was subsequently disbarred by the Florida Supreme Court for having done so. Yet even prior to his disbarment, both the Florida Supreme Court and a U.S. District Court each had previously disciplined him. In January of 2011, Mr. Hammer received a public reprimand from the Florida Supreme Court for having taken actions in both state and bankruptcy courts that he knew or should have known were not meritorious, but instead disruptive to the tribunals. Roughly 2 months later, the Florida court suspended his law license for 3 months for his failure to comply with the conditions of the underlying Bilzerian proceeding. The U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia also issued a civil contempt order against him in July of 2010 for commencing 4 separate lawsuits. Mr. Hammer's abuse of the legal process was ongoing. In May of 2010, he filed a civil suit against 32 defendants in which he alleged, among other things, extortion, libel, slander, fraud, tortious interference, and unjust enrichment. Most of the defendants named in that suit were largely affiliated with the companies from whom he converted money and for which he was disbarred in Florida. Within 2 months of filing that lawsuit, he voluntarily dismissed it, claiming that he had resolved the issues with a significant group of the defendants. Then, in 2013, Mr. Hammer filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy. By his own admission, he reported that he used the pro se filing to forestall his family's eviction process and not be because he intended to discharge any of his debts. 1 month later, he voluntarily dismissed that petition. Those filings illustrate Mr. Hammer's disregard of the legal process for any legitimate aim. By filing claims for which there was no sound basis, and without ever having a true intention of pursuing them, he blatantly engaged in an abuse of the legal system for his own gain. His disbarment and his other misconduct standing alone would certainly have been a sufficient basis to deny him certification. However, his applicant file revealed additional disturbing conduct, namely that he had amassed 56 traffic citations since 1998 and had his driving privileges suspended 19 different times. Moreover, at the time he applied for admission to law school, he failed to report those traffic violations on his application. Because of his failure to disclose those violations, his law school placed him on probation and directed him to complete an ethics course. The excessive number of citations also underscore his disregard for the law and suggest that he believes he is not required to abide by it. By having misappropriated client funds for his own use while licensed as an attorney in Florida, Mr. Hammer demonstrated a deficiency in honesty and integrity. By having been disbarred from the practice of law by the Florida Supreme Court for that conduct, the board found that he demonstrated a lack of character and fitness, which is essential for admission to the Wisconsin Bar. The board also found that by engaging in repeated acts of misconduct, including a civil contempt and abusing the legal process, Mr. Hammer failed to demonstrate that he has the necessary character and fitness required for admission in this state. A record that manifests a deficiency in one's honesty, diligence, or reliability may form a basis for denying admission. Applicants ultimately have the burden of establishing to the satisfaction of the board and this court that they have met the character and fitness requirements for admission. Mr. Hammer believes that since his disbarment, he has been engaged in activities that sufficiently demonstrate rehabilitation such that he should be admitted to the practice of law in Wisconsin. In particular, Mr. Hammer points to the ethics training he underwent with attorney Dean Dietrich as a primary basis for his rehabilitation. However, the board concluded that the training he underwent with attorney Dietrich was limited and brief. Further, attorney Dietrich conceded that his assessment of Mr. Hammer was subjective and not based in law, and that the Board of Bar Examiners bears the responsibility for making character determinations, not character witnesses like attorney Dietrich. Attorney Dietrich also noted that it is most often young lawyers who fail to maintain proper accounting records who wind up in violation of the trust account rules. But here, however, no one has suggested the improper record keeping was the reason for Mr. Hammer's wrongdoing. Rather, he simply took those funds knowingly and flagrantly. It bears repeating that Mr. Hammer was also directed to complete an ethics course by his law school after he failed to disclose traffic violations on his application for admission. Despite having taken that course, he went on to engage in multiple acts of attorney misconduct. There is no reason to believe that the ethics tutorial in which he engaged with attorney Dietrich will have any more of a discernible effect on Mr. Hammer now than the ethics course that he was directed to take by his law school did. Indeed, Mr. Hammer undoubtedly has a thorough understanding of and knowledge about the ethical and fiduciary duties required of lawyers. But regardless of his awareness of those obligations, he repeatedly chose to ignore them and has pointed to little else to demonstrate any tangible rehabilitation. Mr. Hammer has cited his physically healthy lifestyle and the development of a successful business as additional evidence of rehabilitation. But thus far, he has not addressed the ways in which his business would avoid actual or potential conflicts of interest with his would-be future legal employer. He has also made no effort to regain his law license in Florida, nor has he engaged in any therapeutic treatment to determine why he took the funds to begin and how he would prevent himself from ever engaging in similar conduct in the future. Additionally, he has not demonstrated an interest in or commitment to his community through the investment of time, which would arguably also speak to his character. The board, as the fact finder, was neither convinced nor persuaded by Mr. Hammer's explanations for his wrongdoing.
Director Austin?
Yes.
Could you speak a little bit more to Mr. Hammer's business that he started? It appears to be a successful business. I've started a business, a couple businesses before myself. It takes an awful lot of character and determination to do that. Should that inform our analysis on whether he has the character necessary to practice law?
I think it's certainly one element to consider, but I don't think it's determinative of whether or not he should be admitted. The board did not find Mr. Hammer's explanations to be compelling or believable, and as such, they did not find him to be credible. All applicants to the bar, including those who are admitted with conditions, must meet the requisite character and fitness requirements in order to be admitted. However, conditional admission was not designed to address applicants who exhibit a lack of candor and/or credibility for admission. And in this case, the board determined that Mr. Hammer lacked the necessary character and fitness for admission. Because those are essential components for both conditional as well as non-conditional admission, and since Mr. Hammer was lacking in that critical requirement, the board did not extend an offer of conditional admission to him. This court has a history of having considered a variety of admissions matters over the past several decades. Generally speaking, those admissions cases have fallen into three categories. In the first category, this court has upheld board determinations where an applicant has been denied certification for admission. In the second category of cases, the court has found an applicant's character to be troubling, but not sufficiently so to preclude that person from admission. In those cases, the court ultimately certified applicants for admission after determining that they had demonstrated the necessary character and fitness to practice law in Wisconsin, including, for instance, because the applicant had undergone treatment, had engaged in extensive community service, had glowing testimonials from employers, or where a considerable amount of time had lapsed since the applicant engaged in the concerning conduct, or a combination of all of those things. All of which demonstrated to the court that the applicant had been rehabilitated such that his or her admission was warranted. In the third category of cases, this court has found that an applicant's behavior, while certainly troubling, was nevertheless offset by positive character evidence such that admission was warranted, albeit conditioned by terms uniquely fashioned and determined by this court. While it is within the court's prerogative to impose conditions upon applicants for admission to the bar when warranted, it remains outside of the scope of the board's authority to do so. Short of the conditions delineated in Supreme Court Rule 40.075, only the court retains the express authority to determine whether there are special circumstances under which other types of conditions may be imposed upon an applicant to the bar. Given the seriousness of this case, it is the board's belief that Mr. Hammer should not be granted admission and that the board's decision to not certify him for an admission should be upheld. Similarly, the board does not believe that this is a case in which the court should admit him, even with the imposition of special conditions. After only 4 years in practice and after taking thousands of dollars in trust funds, the Florida Supreme Court disbarred Mr. Hammer from the practice of law. But even before being disbarred, he had already been disciplined by both the Florida Supreme Court and by the United States District Court. Throughout the course of his hearing before the board, a number of explanations emerged as to why his wrongdoing occurred. Those explanations consistently laid the blame for his misconduct on someone other than Mr. Hammer and consistently rang hollow. The board did not find his explanations to be credible or convincing and ultimately concluded that Mr. Hammer rationalized his misconduct by insisting that he was entitled to the money he took. That, in addition to his filing of a questionable civil suit and later a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, called into question his character and fitness to practice law in Wisconsin. When his traffic history is added to that equation, Mr. Hammer's character and fitness is further undermined. While many of these misdeeds occurred several years ago, there is little support in the record to conclude that Mr. Hammer is sufficiently rehabilitated such that he should now be admitted to the practice of law in this state. He has not demonstrated the fundamental and requisite characteristics for admission, namely that he is honest, diligent, trustworthy, or reliable. By engaging in a sustained pattern of misconduct, the board determined that Mr. Hammer has not met his burden of establishing that he possesses the essential characteristics for admission to the bar. I do want to take a moment also to respond to Mr. Hammer's claim with regard to the Piper matter. And I want to make it clear that while he cites to it for the proposition that jurisdictions who solely admit in-state residents to the exclusion of all out-of-state residents are in violation of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the board believes that Mr. Hammer definitely misconstrues the board's character and fitness analysis, and then he also misapplies the court's decision in the Piper matter. Unlike the New Hampshire Board of Bar Examiners in the Piper case, where she was denied admission solely based on her residency, the Wisconsin board did not base its denial of certification on the state in which Mr. Hammer resides. Instead, it denied him certification for admission because he repeatedly failed to demonstrate that he has the requisite elements of character and fitness necessary for the practice of law in Wisconsin. As a result, the board believes that he should be barred from engaging in the practice of law in this state, and I therefore respectfully request that you uphold the board's decision denying him certification for admission. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Hammer, are you prepared to begin rebuttal? You're still muted.
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
In retrospect, I practiced law between the ages of 24 to 28 when I was not mature enough to practice law, particularly without a mentor. Today, at 38 years old, I'm a very different, more mature, grounded man. I'm very capable to take on the responsibilities of a lawyer in an ethical manner. In no way do I excuse my prior conduct, and I accept responsibility for my actions. I want to address a couple items that Director Rothstein raised. I do contend that the board's factual findings regarding what it found to be my abuse process is error, but that it is harmless error. The board's primary issues related to my practice of law. There was a question about whether my repayment of the funds, which I improperly withdrew, acted to absolve. And of course, it doesn't act to completely absolve or undo what I did. However, if you look at the reinstatement cases and the suspension and revocation cases issued by this court, each and every one of them says that prior to revocation, repatriation of any funds that were taken is a prerequisite. I did that, in fact, before the Florida Bar ever brought any charge or any complaint against me. There was a question that was asked about whether the standard for character and fitness is the same as the standard for reinstatement. I don't know the answer to that question, but I suggest that under both standards that the court has articulated in both sorts of cases, the court has found that sufficient time has elapsed in far less time than mine. So in the reinstatement cases, yes, I maintain 6 to 18 months, both from Dean Dietrich's expert testimony as well as the OLR cases that I've cited. But also in the case.
Yes. I'd like to ask a question that's of concern to me. You have 4 years of practice in Florida, 4 disciplinary actions, including disbarment, 2 contempt orders, multiple orders imposing sanctions, you have the BBE finding that you're not a credible witness, and we have a 40.06 sub 4 that indicates that disbarment in another state is alone a basis for not allowing admission. In view of all that, why should you be admitted to practice law? Why do you believe that we should find that you have the necessary character and fitness?
Sure. So first, let me just address one particular item, and then I'll ask, and then I'll answer the entire question. Relative to 40.06 sub 4, reading the legislative history of that particular rule, I think what the court was going for with that rule is that if a disciplinary proceeding is instated in another state and that is pending, that this court should consider that. In this case, it is no longer pending. It has been resolved a long time ago and no longer a member of the Florida bar. But as to your overall question, Your Honor, I suggest that, you know, there are, as Director Rothstein pointed out, multiple categories of applicants. There are some applicants like Leroy Martin whose conduct was so serious that they should never be given another chance. That Leroy Martin applied to law school from prison and didn't disclose it. He had multiple felony convictions. I've never been convicted of a crime other than speeding in the state of Georgia, which is a misdemeanor there. I made some terrible mistakes during my law practice, but it was 10 years ago. And my suggestion is that my conduct overall was not so serious that it suggests that I should be forever banned, right? And that tracks the language of this court's decision in Ripple and in Anderson, that it shouldn't be a forever ban.
But
counsel, could you then,
could you have the opportunity, if you were denied, to reapply again?
I'm sorry, Justice Bradley, I didn't understand what you, could you repeat what you said?
Yes, I don't have my usual little rules book in front of me, but if you are denied admission, you have the opportunity to reapply for admission at a later date, is my understanding. Let me ask, that's my understanding. So you may not be forever banned, is my point.
May I respond, Your Honor? I understand my time is up.
Yes, you may respond.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I understand that procedurally, the BBE might accept another application from me, my suggestion is that it would be futile, that a sufficient amount of time has elapsed without any troubling conduct, that I would suggest that the imposition of more time, which was needed for some of these other applicants whose applications were not fully candid, whose troubling conduct occurred very recently, some of whom even committed crimes very recently, that doesn't apply to me. My troubling conduct was over 10 years ago. So what will another year or two or three do to help the situation? So while sure, Your Honor is certainly technically correct that I would have another opportunity to reapply, the question is, why would the result that obtained be any different?
Okay. Thank you very much. And counsel, thank both of you for fine arguments. This is a new medium for the courts, but and for you too, but it seems like it's moving along. I'm very pleased that you were able to participate this way. The court is now going to adjourn, and we will meet in closed conference at 3:05, and for all the justices and Julie, that's on a different Zoom invitation than the one we have used today. So.